2, Deuteronomy 6, and our question, you remember, in the first part of this term is, do we matter to God? Do we matter to God? And I did say right at the beginning that this question is not the other way around. Does God matter to you? I dare say I could ask that question, and I think I would know the answers that I would variably get from many different people. Not really very interesting, because we know the different opinions that people have about God, the apathy, the antagonism, and sometimes the enthusiasm. The question that we're asking ourselves is a very, very much more important one than the question, does God matter to you? The question we're asking is, do we matter to God? Is there any evidence from the biblical record that God is in the least interested in our lives, in our work, in our aspirations, in our destiny? We might look at the universe, we might look in a number of different directions, and get no clue that God was really concerned. Our question, therefore, is to turn to the Bible to see what evidence we can get that God is concerned. Now, the reason I've given tonight is that God is a lawgiver. And rather than chapter 5, which shows us the law of God, which is on your card, I've chosen, in fact, to look at chapter 6. And realizing that it would be impossible to read through that whole chapter, though it's well worth doing, incidentally, and you find the word commandment or statute or ordinance on almost every page, I decided to choose just one verse. I will actually be looking at other verses, which is number 24. Deuteronomy chapter 6, and the number of the verse, 24. Then I decided that that would be too long for us to carry away in our heads for the whole week, and I'm determined to give you a phrase that you'll remember when I meet you in the street on Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday. And that is the phrase in the middle of verse 24. I'll read the verse and then underline the phrase. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as at this day. And the phrase that I want to underline in red ink and underline in your mind is that little phrase of four words, for our good always. And once or twice as a kind of slogan or motto, I'm going to repeat that, and I may as we go and ask you to repeat it. For our good always. And that is, in a sense, my answer to our question. Do we matter to God? Well, I think the fact that God reveals himself in the Old Testament, indeed throughout the Bible, as a lawgiver for our good always, is part of our answer to the question, does God care about us? He has gone to the trouble of giving us commandments, statutes, and ordinances for our good always, because he does care for mankind. Now, I thought that what Stephen Cox said very movingly just a few minutes ago is incredibly relevant, really, to our study tonight. It isn't enough to know the law of God. It isn't enough to know the will of God. We've actually got to do it. And I must take it for granted that you accepted that as he said it. It isn't enough for me to tell you that this law is for our good. Obviously, the benefits become ours as we seek in the power of God's Spirit to obey it. And I shall say something about that tonight and something later on in the series. Let me start a little far out and say that for all of us, if we think for a moment, law as part of society, part of life, law and order, if you like that rather modern political phrase, law is essential to the health and happiness of any human society. I wonder how many of us, probably very few here, have ever lived for even a short time in a comparatively lawless society. I actually have, and I never want to live in such a place again. We have no idea, living in our society, of how fortunate we are to live in a society which aims to keep the rule of law. I was actually with Stephen and Elizabeth Cox at lunch today, and they kindly drove me back in their jalopy. And I was sitting in the back meditating on one of the things. You can't meditate on much in that car because it makes a lot of noise. But I was, as far as I could, meditating on these things and thinking about a lawless society. And I was thinking of a near comparatively lawless one. I have one in my mind, where if you were going along in a car like that, you were very likely to meet a police block along the road. And if you meet a police block along the road in the particular society I'm thinking of, and there are many in this world, the soldiers will stop you, because it's likely to be soldiers rather than police, and they will ask some more or less unimportant formal question. And then when you think that you're going to be allowed to go on, they won't allow you to go on, and they will begin to ask you whether you have any money. They've made very clear that you're expected to produce it. And should you be rather brash and bold and refuse to do so, then it's likely that Elizabeth, sitting there expecting a child, would be knocked about to a greater or lesser extent. And that wouldn't be a very happy way of spending our afternoon, would it? But it would be absolutely normal, because the rule of law is not effective in a society like that, and therefore no one is going to bring these people to book. Imagine what it would have been like to be in China during the Cultural Revolution, when there was no law, when people simply stalked the land doing exactly what they wanted. I suppose we can really have no idea of this, and if we do have an idea of a lawless society, we make it into a Western film, which is all rather fun. I love Westerns and often watch one on my day off if there's a good one on the telly. And I love it as the sheriff gets into trouble and the horses gallop past the same bit of studio 55 times, shooting in all directions, and I'm never hit, and I just have another cup of coffee, and I know the hero is going to win in the end, and I see wood splintered all around the hero, but it never hits him, it always hits everybody else, and so on. You know, we love that, as long as we don't have to come anywhere near it in reality. I suppose the only thing we know in industrialized Western society is after dark in the great urban areas. And if we've experienced any kind of lawlessness, with a small L or a big L, then we cry out for law. Why, we cry out for it even in small things. We may be watching Wimbledon. We may be having to watch John McEnroe. And we cry out to have a referee who's actually going to insist on the law. You see, in the other professionals, when they didn't get that, all ganged up together and said, all right, if you're not going to keep the law, we're going to see to it that we make it impossible for him to go on behaving like that. In other words, we just can't live like that. And the message of the Bible is that God is concerned to provide us law. Now, we're going to stay in Deuteronomy, but I felt I couldn't go through this evening, because we shan't have another opportunity to do it, without asking you to turn up Romans 13. I'm going to read just a few verses from the beginning of Romans 13, and I'm not going to say anything about it. I will let it speak for itself. It is part of the Bible. It doesn't seem to be part of the Bible in many churches today or in many Christian lives today. People seem to have forgotten it. Many people conveniently cut it out. But here it is, I'll let it speak for itself. It again shows God's concern for authority. And he's not talking here about Christian countries, but the generality of the rule of law. Romans 13, verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority whatever except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Obviously, questions arise there when the authority is given wholly to evil, but the basic principle remains. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. Now, I should tell you that in the book of Revelation, the New Testament deals with the issue of what you do when the whole state becomes given over to evil and is called the beast. But that's another matter. In the normal course of life, that is the commandment of God, because he wants us to live lives that are reasonable, healthy and happy, so that we can move amongst ourselves. Now we'll get back to Deuteronomy and the Ten Commandments. Now the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5 are one of the greatest blessings the world has ever received. They are not arbitrary. They are not like the rules that were laid down when I first joined the services and had some elementary training. I've been thinking with a certain amount of pity about poor Prince Edward with his commando training. I know what those early days are like. And when you go for those early days, the sergeant major makes his own rules, or the petty officer, I was in the Navy, and he has endless, tiresome rules that he has made up all day, so that you never can win. You're always in the wrong, and you're always on the run. And of course, it's a great pleasure to the petty officer and the sergeant major to do it, because he's, so to speak, breaking you in. Now, I want to tell you that God is not a heavenly sergeant major breaking us in with arbitrary laws, rather like the gods of classical Greece. God's laws are descriptive of reality. I want to repeat that. It's rather a pompous phrase, but I couldn't think of any other. God's laws are descriptive of reality. That is to say, they describe the world as God has made it, and they are, therefore, the instructions the Maker gives to us as to how He's made the world and how it will work. They are, therefore, given to us not to frustrate us, but to explain the nature of the world that God has made and to give us the benefit of understanding it. When I was young, my mother often used to send me out into the woodshed in the garden to split logs. I am, to this day, an expert splitter of logs through that experience. At first, I used to think it was grand to get hold of the axe and heave and make the most tremendous swipes, whether I hit or not, and often it would simply bounce off the top of the log. I expect you found that experience. Then I discovered simply, I wasn't told, I discovered it through doing it, that if you turn the log the right way around so that you get the grain in line with the axe, then you don't have to take one of these tremendous Jack Nicklaus golf swings and come down on it. You only have to do half the swing and it goes straight through very sweetly. And to this day, I can't bear seeing someone splitting logs who doesn't know how to do it. And that's life, isn't it? Once we've learned the law of how it works, once we realize the way in which the grain goes, then we adapt ourselves to the way in which the grain goes, and life is much easier. Now, what the law of God is doing is to tell us which way the grain is going in the world that God has made. And I'm going to illustrate this with two or three ones that go to the very heart of life. And I'll start with your time, because I know you're always short of it. And we'll look at the fourth commandment, which is in verse 12 to 15 of chapter 5. I won't read it. I will simply tell you the heading. Verse 12 of chapter 5, Deuteronomy, observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, if I read all those words, 12 through to 15, I think some of you within would be saying, oh no, don't go back to all that. That's the Victorian Sunday. What a dreadful burden. What horrible afternoons they used to have. Everything nice put away for the children. Having to go to church 14 times. Oh, it was terrible. You don't mean to say that St. Helens stands for bringing that back. If so, it'll be pretty empty in the Sundays to come. Well, this is God's commandment. He hasn't abrogated it. He claims our time. But he makes in the New Testament a marvelous statement. And if you're going to read Mark Land, don't bother to turn this up. You will soon meet it. It comes, actually, in Mark 2:27, and you won't have time to turn it up before I read it to you. So listen. Jesus said to them concerning the Sabbath, and this is a terrific statement, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In other words, Jesus had seen that the religious idiots of his own day had done what religious idiots so often do, turned the whole thing the other way around, as though we existed in order to keep the Sabbath. Now that's a perversion of the Bible teaching. We do not exist to keep the Sabbath. And some Victorians clearly did believe that. It's always unwise, actually, to criticize another age. I don't know what they'd have to say about us in certain ways. No, we do not exist to keep the Sabbath. The Sabbath exists that we may exist. In other words, it is one of God's greatest blessings to us. God has given us in that commandment a rhythm of work and rest. And incidentally, there's a rhythm of work as well as rest. And if, miserably at the moment, you are unemployed, as one or two of you are, through no desire of your own, I must urge you to discipline yourself and to do some work, to find some activity, to help a church nearby or do something, even though for the moment you have to be on the dole, because, in fact, God has made us to work, and if we simply stay in bed, we begin to rot. We all know that. But here, the rhythm is that of rest. And God lays down that we need this rest, 1 in 7. In wartime in this country, for a short time, some munition factories sought to have 7-day weeks at certain crisis points in the war, when we were expending ammunition faster than it could be made. And it was discovered statistically that a factory working flat out for 7 days produced less than a factory working flat out for 6 days. That's a pleasant bit of statistics, isn't it? Yet, of course, the moment you know the rhythm that God has made, it is common sense. Because when people were trying to work for 7 days, they found they had not the strength to work as they were working for the 6 days. In the Russian Revolution, because they were trying to throw out everything to do with Christianity in the Bible, they tried a 9-day week and soon had to stop it. You see, what God is doing here is he's saying, this is for your benefit. I'm telling you to stop it because your work will master you. I remember some dreadful digs that I went to in up in the Hampstead direction when I first came here, and there wasn't a rectory. They were the most dreadful places, and there were the most extraordinary characters. I sometimes still think of them and wonder how they're getting on. And there was one man who used to sit at the end of the table who was a pajama manufacturer. And he went off every morning very early in his Jaguar because pajamas pay. And he came back very late. He thought of nothing except pajamas. And on Sunday morning, he used to have a lie-in. And then breakfast was later, and he used to sit at the end of the table, drumming his fingers, unable to think of anything. And it's quite clear, you see, that he didn't know what to do. And gradually, he would edge his way away from the table and slip round to the garage, and by about 10:30, he'd be off in the Jaguar to see the pajamas and how they were getting on. In other words, he couldn't stop. He actually was on it 7 days a week. Now, that many, of course, people are doing that today, aren't they? And so we have a new thing invented called a sabbatical. It's rather interesting what it's called, isn't it? Because people will not stop, they have to have sabbaticals, which is simply from the same word meaning a rest. It's not without interest, is it, that holy day, which is what the Sabbath is the beginning of what we mean by holiday. So God invents right at the beginning of time a holiday once a week. Calls it a holy day. God gave it, indeed God commanded it. He commands it because you need it. And if you work at exam time even 7 days a week, you will find you're less efficient than you are if you work for 6 days. God made us as we are. He knows our physical, mental, psychological equilibrium. He knows how we're made. He knows every part of the intricacy which is my personality. And he knows that I need this. And I personally have discovered that he's right. And I no longer have a conscience, as I used to have, about my day off, which always, of course, for me, comes in the middle of the week. So in the middle of the week, I go off in my country clothes, and everybody thinks, isn't he lucky, having nothing to do? You can see them looking out of the offices. And my conscience begins to work. And then I remind myself, it's a commandment that I should have a holiday like this. God knows I need it, and I enjoy it. I'm already looking forward to next Friday. That's the first illustration. Now, you see, that illustration illustrates my point. It is for our good always. God has laid that down not to make us Victorian Sabbatarians, but for our good always, because he wants us to live and not be chained to our work. I mean, fancy being chained to pajamas, but then fancy being chained to anything. It's pathetic, isn't it? You just saw some of our businessmen. Just, it's just so pathetic to see some of our Christians backsliding. Unable to think of anything else. Second illustration, marriage, Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Now, I want you to look at Genesis 2, 24. I could have taken it from the commandments, but this is particularly good. I want you to look at this with one finger and Matthew 19, 5 with another finger. We never look more at 10 references at once. Because we understand about your fingers. Genesis 2:24. I'm only going to look at a very small amount because time is not on our side. Here is God laying down the law. God can't speak, incidentally, without laying the law. God has never opened his mouth without laying down the law, because everything God says has the force of commandment. It must do, because it's the truth. Verse 24, having brought woman to man, verse 24 we read, therefore a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they both became one flesh. He leaves and cleaves. And it's interesting that in Matthew 19:5, we're told that God said this. It isn't just written in Genesis. God says, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined, that is, cleave to his wife. Now here is the law then. If I am to enjoy that great gift of God, which is marriage, I am to leave the home from which I come. That means that the new relationship is an exclusive one. I cannot run two homes at once. Got that? In view of the last week or so? I cannot run two homes at once. That's what the law of God says. So I have to leave if I want a partner. I have to leave the home I was in. Secondly, I am to cleave to the new person, to the wife, and she to me. That means it is permanent. I cleave and I can't be unclothed, whatever the word is. It is therefore exclusive and permanent, and that is written into the maker's instructions. Let's put it in a very much more blunt way. What that verse is saying is that bed and board go together. God says right from the beginning, because God made us, that if we want bed, then there's got to be a board. In other words, to talk about living together means in the Bible exactly what it says. I can't live together without living together. Got it? The privilege of bed means the responsibility of board. I can't promise the one without promising the other. Again, we've seen this illustrated. Now, I can't turn that round absolutely the other way and say that board must mean bed, of course. Though I think there's a warning there. I don't have a girl lodger in the rectory because I think there's a warning there. People would only assume that if I gave lodging to a girl, I gave my bed to her. For the same reason, because of the deplorable declension of our social life, I don't have, though I used to have, a man lodger. Just because there is a reputation that one has to maintain, obviously, in Christian work. And the world, because it seeks to believe the worst of friendships, will often put a label on something that is, of course, perfectly normal. So, there is a warning that if I have board together, people will think sometimes there is bed together, but the order is bed and board. If I want bed, then there must be board. That's God's rule. Now, after all, we ought to listen to God since he invented love and he invented family and he invented relationships. In other words, he did this for our good always. And I just want to say that if we go against the grain, if we try to split the logs against the grain, we shall pay a terrible price. And I must honestly say that I feel so much for the chief actors in the drama of the last week. What a miserable thing to have all these reporters chasing you day in and day out. But at least there is no doubt in anybody's mind as a result of it that the three people most intimately concerned are paying an extraordinary price. An extraordinary price. Indeed, when I tried to put it down on paper, I could hardly come to the end of the price that they're having to pay. I'm not going to do that because it's not our business. Now you see, what God is doing is to hedge his greatest gifts around with law in order to preserve and protect them. Just as when I go to Oxford, I'm thankful to be able, if I've got a few minutes, to walk into Christchurch Meadow. And I love those laws on the gates. You know them? No one here shall commit a nuisance. No one here shall bowl a hoop. So I put away my hoop. I think those laws must have been put out on the gate by Christchurch when Lewis Carroll was a don, don't you? They haven't been changed since. But they've been kept. They've been kept. And so I can walk peacefully. Perhaps I'm speaking at a meeting or seeing somebody. I can walk around those marvelous meadows and no one will bowl a hoop or kick a ball through my feet. No one will seek to sell me ice cream or popcorn. No one will drive a car across the meadow because the law has been kept. In other words, it's a gloriously peaceful place in the middle of an industrial, miserably traffic-clogged city. Not quite so clogged, perhaps, as it was. If you want the benefit of these things, you've got to hedge them about with law because man is sinful. If you dislike the idea of law, it's only because you are sinful that God had to do it. He wanted to hedge around these very precious things that he'd given us. He's given us time, so he hedges it around. Don't spend all your time at work. He's given us the precious gift of family and love and personal relationships, so he hedges it around with law. Third illustration. And now we'll turn back to Deuteronomy 5 and 6, please. And we'll look at the first commandment, which is in verse 7 of chapter 5 and verse 4 of chapter 6. Verse 7 of chapter 5, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment. By the way, you notice that all the laws of God so far are for everybody. I know these are addressed to the Israelites, but everybody has to do with time, and everybody has to do with family, and those laws are for everybody, not just for those who are Christians. Chapter 6, verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and with all your might. Now, it's very interesting that when Jesus quotes that law in Mark, and you'll get to this in chapter 9 of Mark, that he quotes verse 4 before he comes to verse 5. And being asked what is the chief commandment, he says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall. And that actually makes my point for me today beautifully. You see, the law of God in verse 5 depends upon the reality of verse 4. The reality in the universe is that there is only one God, and all the other gods are nonentities. Therefore, God would preserve us from making fools of ourselves. He wants to preserve mankind from idolatry, because in idolatry I'm worshipping something which doesn't exist. I'm giving something my ultimate loyalty which doesn't deserve it. So he sought to preserve people from being so foolish. Realizing there is only one God, therefore the whole of my heart must be given to that God. I was sitting at table today at lunch, and Stephen and Elizabeth were there, and there were six of us. And the most magnificent lemon mousse cake was brought to the table, cut into six places. I wasn't asked first, of course, but if I had been, I might have replied. My hostess might have said, Would you like some cake? And my reply would have been, Yes, I'll have the whole of it. Well, the lady who was offered the first might well have thought that. Didn't say it, I hasten to say, might have thought it. But of course, I wouldn't say that, not only because I hope I'm not quite as greedy as that, but because I realized that the other five people around the table had an equal right to their slice of lemon mousse cake. But here is your heart, you see. And we turn to God and we say, Now what do you want? And God says, I want the whole of it. You say, Well, that's pretty rude. Haven't you got any manners? And God says, I want the whole of it. Now listen to this, because it's very important. God says, I want the whole of it because no one else has the right to any of it. Do you see the point? He's saying there is no one else who has the right to any of it, so I must have all of it. And if you want to cut a fifth off and give it to materialism, or if you want to cut part of it off and give it to sex mania behavior, many people do, well, you are giving your ultimate loyalty to something which isn't a God and cannot repay you and cannot fulfill what you want from it because it isn't a God. Now, this is the first commandment. And it's of very great interest to me that when a person becomes a regenerate Christian, a born-again converted Christian, you may not yet know what that is. If not, you've got a great joy ahead of you when you discover for yourself. When a person becomes a real Christian, the very first thing to be attacked in their life is often the first commandment. Have you ever realized that? And the first commandment is attacked, you see, because what has happened is that this person, instead of being a nominal member of whatever it is, the congregational church or the this, that, or the other, has become a wholehearted follower of Jesus Christ. And so friends and even people who love us say things like this, Must you read the Bible all the time? Of course, you're not reading the Bible all the time. But that's what the world thinks about somebody who reads the Bible at all. Or, you know, I always felt, Bill, that moderation was a useful thing in religion, like everything else people say to us. Oh, don't be so fanatical, our brother or sister says to us. And Uncle Bill, who is a Freemason, he says, you know, Jack, I just want to have a word with you. I'm awfully glad about these new church loyalties you've been learning in London, but you know, in our lodge, we have a rule that's a very useful rule. We never talk about religion or politics. And you know, you've got to keep these things in their place if you want to get on, my boy. And Uncle Bill means very well
He really is concerned for us, but he doesn't understand the first commandment of all. Amazing, isn't it? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, mind. Is that clear, isn't it? Is that too much of a good thing? Well, then you better throw the commandments away. Now, I just want to finish by saying that these three illustrations go to the heart of life. They talk of the things that are most precious to us. They talk about our time. They talk about our family, relationships. They talk about our ultimate loyalties. And God gives us commandments for our good always. Just look back at chapter 6. It's repeated again and again. You see, he says in verse 2 of chapter 6, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Verse 3, hear therefore, Israel, be careful to do them, that it may go well with you. Verse 18, you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may go well with you. Now, you will only do this if you both love the Lord and fear the Lord. You see, the chapter tells you to love the Lord in verse 4, but it also tells you to fear the Lord repeatedly. And it makes it plain that the way we fear the Lord is by keeping the commandments. Verse 24 again, the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes to fear the Lord our God. And shall I tell you why I believe there is practically no fear of God in our country? It's because the commandments are no longer regarded as central to life. A Christian both loves and fears the Lord, and therefore he regards the laws that God has given him. I wish I could say this of myself. I wish I could say of my Christian life that I've always regarded these laws as one of the greatest blessings that God has given me. I fear that often I have kicked against these laws, feeling that if only I could just bend them a little bit, I'd enjoy life better. I'm afraid I've been like that, and I guess you've been like that too. Before I close, let me say that the law has been given not only to prolong your days, but also to show you your need of a Savior. We shall be coming to that later on in the term. And it shows you your need of a Savior by making you realize that when God has given you this great benefit, you constantly fail to live up to it. The Apostle Paul said that the 10th commandment was the one that showed him that in verse 21 of chapter 5. Look at it. Neither shall you covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, or his car, or his motorbike, or his salary, or his friends, or his job. And as I look at that, I have to say, Lord, I don't have the power to keep that law. You see, these laws not only show us the way to live, but they humble us, and they show us that we can never be acceptable in our own strength, and that that extraordinary misunderstanding that so many people in our country have, that we shall be saved and go to heaven by our own works, couldn't possibly be so, because there is not one of us in this church that can keep the commandments. Let me finish with the story that I have often told from this pulpit. I don't think I've told it this year, so I've got one chance. But I tell it because it made such a deep impression upon me, and such a deep impression on the only other person concerned. A girl came to see me in the rag office of a university in Africa. She was a tremendous person. And she'd come after a talk that I'd given the night before in the university. And she wanted to sign up as a Christian, she told me. And I was in this student office, and I had a piece of white blotting paper in front of me. And I wrote a sentence down, and I said, I'm going to write three sentences down, and if you want to be a Christian, you must be willing to tick each one. First sentence was, I do not keep God's law. And she was willing to tick that because she knew very well that she did not keep God's law in its entirety. Then I wrote, I cannot keep God's law. And this time she was inclined to kick a bit, but after we talked for a while, I pointed out that if we did not keep God's law persistently, it was because we didn't have the strength to do so. And in the end, she was willing to tick, and then looked at me rather quizzically as to what I was going to write next. And I wrote next, I do not even wish to keep God's law. And she was very annoyed with me. She said, here am I coming to tell you that I enjoyed the talk last night and want to be a Christian. You've done nothing but put me off. And I said, well, I only wanted you to know the truth before you ask Christ to be your Savior. You need a Redeemer because you don't keep His law, you can't keep it, and deep down in your heart, if your heart is like mine, though you want to keep God's law most days, when God's law is unequivocally clear, and my will is unequivocally clear but goes the other way, I don't even want to keep it, and I get fed up with God for laying it down. And not without some sorrow of heart, she came to tick that third sentence. And if you can say, I do not keep God's law, I cannot keep God's law in my own strength, and I do not even wish to sometimes, then you're ready to become a Christian if you're not a Christian. The Lord gave us commandments, statutes, and ordinances for our good always. Our gracious and eternal God, we humble ourselves as we were taught to do in our prayer time this evening before so great a God and Father. We thank you with all our hearts that you have not only made this world with all its joys and pleasures, supremely the gift of time, family, friends, but also the gift of your own person and love and truth. And we thank you that you've hedged these great and precious things, that you hedged them around with your law, that they may not be broken, but may be preserved for all generations. And therefore we bow before that law and acknowledge that it is for our good always. And we also have to say with shame that we have often kicked against it and not realized the blessing that comes from it. So we thank you for sending Jesus to be our Redeemer, to redeem us from a broken law, to put His Spirit within us and to change our hearts and to write your law in our hearts. We ask that you will do that again for us tonight. We ask it through Jesus.